This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised. A woman convicted of murdering her children 30 years ago is coming up for parole. Is she ready to rejoin society, or should she remain incarcerated? This is the Susan Smith story. Hello. Today's case is one that most of us are familiar with, as this case captured the attention of the nation and public interest, Amy, has persisted throughout the last 30 years.
I would say this is in top 10 most requested.
Absolutely. Hands down. And the reason I chose to cover it now is because it seems that Susan Smith is in the news again, and it's caused some heated discussion, and I think it will be a great discussion for us later on. The question that this story always ends with is why? And I do promise that we will get to that at the end of the episode. We want to break down the criminology behind this case in particular, which is also why I chose it. Just as an extra trigger warning, we discuss themes involving violence against children in this episode, so extra listener discretion is advised for this one. And now let's turn to Susan Smith. Susan Lee Vaughn was born in 1971 in Union, South Carolina, to parents Linda and Harry Vaughn. Linda had a son from a previous relationship who she raised with her husband Harry, and the couple had Susan and another son together. Though Susan adored her father and was very close to him, Harry and Linda had a very turbulent relationship, causing serious dysfunction in the home. And for all that, Susan loved her dad. But Harry was an alcoholic and he was violent towards Linda, which distressed the children, put a serious strain on the family. And by 1977, when Susan was just 6 years old, Linda divorced Harry, which sent him into a spiral of heavier drinking and depression. Unfortunately, Amy, and devastatingly to Susan, Harry took his own life shortly after the divorce, and Linda remarried a man named Beverly Russell, known as Bev. Bev was a successful businessman with daughters from a previous marriage. Linda and her children moved in with Bev, and though Susan would go on to do very well in school and with no documented behavioral problems, she felt a terrible void in her life from the absence of her father because she was so close with him, and because most children would feel that type of void regardless of how close they were with the parent. When Susan went to high school, she was involved in a lot of activities, Amy. She had a lot of friends, but she was also hiding a secret. See, Susan longed for the attention of her father, and in his absence, she tried to warm up to Bev to gain his attention. But in doing so, Bev had taken advantage of Susan and sexually molested her.
Oh, that's awful. To already have someone, a child, dealing with the loss of a parent and then this, like, this is...
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, this happened on several occasions, and eventually Susan did report this to the school counselor. The family received therapy, and while Bev moved out of the home for some time while they dealt with this issue...
You said he moved out of the home. He wasn't arrested?
No, Bev was not arrested for the crime at this time. This was also a different time. Remember, this is the early 1980s.
Did Linda stay with him? Did she believe her daughter? Or
what I don't know
was going on there.
I think she did. I think she believed what I understood or what I read was that they believed a molestation happened, but much like other families, they attributed to Susan's behavior because they said that she was the one who initiated. She was provocative.
It's disgusting.
So, yes, I believe that they acknowledge that a relationship had happened, but they're calling it a relationship and not the type of crime that it was at the time.
How old is she? Because it's also statutory rape.
Yes, it is. At the time she was in high school, I believe she was 15 years old, between 15 and 16 years old.
I'm just so shocked and disgusted that he was not arrested, and it sounds like he was back in the home at some point.
He did return to the home, and he tried to repair the damage. Mm-hmm. However, what the family didn't know is that Bev continued to molest Susan, and without any charges being filed at all. More on that later. I understand how it's very frustrating to hear that. While dealing with this repeated sexual assault at home, Susan was also trying to live a normal life, And she took a job as a cashier at a local Winn-Dixie before entering her senior year of high school. She was really good at her job. Susan was very smart, and she was promoted pretty quickly, maybe in under a year's time, to bookkeeper for Winn-Dixie. But her promotion may have been clouded a little bit by the relationships that she was having with the men that she worked with. One such relationship was with an older man with whom Susan became involved, and she became pregnant by him.
How much older?
I don't know how much older. Okay. He was married. I don't know what the age difference was. She was of age, I believe, at that time, even though albeit very young.
Mm-hmm.
Susan had an abortion with this pregnancy and became severely depressed following the breakup. And in 1988, Susan attempted suicide via an overdose of Tylenol and aspirin. So she would have been 17 at the time. Susan survived, but it was reported that this was her second attempt at ending her life, as she had tried this once previously when she was a younger teenager.
Megan, you mentioned she was of age at this point, but you just said she was 17. And the age of, oh, I guess this was a different time. Age of consent might have been younger.
It might have been 17. So I'm not 100%. So I said I believe she was of age, even if so, very much on the border.
Yeah. Yeah.
After this, Susan dated other men where she worked, eventually meeting David Smith. David had come from a religious family. In particular, his mother was very religious, which reportedly caused a lot of friction in his home because she was so strictly religious and his father was not. But David was described as a very nice young man who began working as a teen and developed a very strong work ethic at a young age. Now, when they met, David was actually engaged to someone else. But he had a relationship with Susan anyway, I think expecting from what I read for it to be kind of a short fling. But that all changed in 1990 when Susan found out that she was pregnant. David told his then fiance about the situation and ended the relationship with her, opting to marry Susan and raise their baby boy, Michael, together. David and Susan married in 1991, though their relationship, Amy, was rocky from the start. So it's interesting because you know the case, it's been in the headlines, but you just don't know all of these details until you really dig into it. And I don't remember this, but remember, they were very young, 19 and 20.
Mm-hmm.
They both engaged in extramarital affairs right from the beginning of the relationship. Susan enrolled in some local college courses, I think hoping for a better life. I also think Susan's stepfather, Bev, was successful and she came from a little bit more money than David.
Mm-hmm.
But financially, Susan and David, they made decent livings from their jobs. David was a manager at the Winn-Dixie and Susan was a bookkeeper. And from what I saw, I'm sure they were young couples with children or always strapped for money, but they were making a decent living.
Was it an abusive relationship?
No, it was not from what I read.
Okay.
Although, you know, what form of abuse you might argue having relationships with other people and it was somewhat mm-hmm. tumultuous, but I do not believe abusive.
Okay.
And even though they were financially stable, it did seem that money was a stressor for them, as it is for a lot of couples. And over the next 2 years, the pair separated more than once, several times. But in 1993, the Smiths bought a nice home and prepared for the arrival of their second child, hoping for a fresh start, thinking, okay, we now have a second child coming. We are going to make this work.
Where were they living? What part of the country?
It was Union, South Carolina.
Okay.
Unfortunately, this new outlook and a fresh start wouldn't last long. After the birth of their second son, Alex, David moved out again, and Susan took a new job at a home decor company called Conso Products. David had found a new girlfriend at his job at the Winn-Dixie, which was one of the reasons Susan decided to leave. She thought this would be uncomfortable, and I believe David was, in effect, her manager. And it wasn't long before Susan was also seeing someone new at her work, a man named Tom Finley, who was considered an eligible and successful young bachelor at the time. Though Susan and David tried to reconcile one more time, it did not work. And Susan filed for divorce from David in September of 1994, as she'd apparently fallen in love with Tom Finley and was ready to end her marriage. But soon after, a crisis would ensue, and Susan would need David. On the evening of October 25th, 1994, a local woman named Shirley McLeod was relaxing at home when she heard a young woman screaming outside her front door. Shirley opened the door to find a frantic Susan Smith, begging to use the phone to call 911 because her children had just been abducted. Shirley obliged, and Susan contacted the sheriff's office, who responded immediately. When Sheriff Wells arrived, I believe he also knew Susan through a family member, and maybe this was, Union's not small, but still smallish, I guess, for towns. When he arrived, he had Susan tell him exactly what happened. So this was what Susan told authorities and Shirley. According to Susan, she was in the car with the children at a stoplight near town, and she named where it was, when a black man jumped in the car and forced her to drive for several miles. When they passed a sign for John D. Long Lake, the man forced her out of the car, saying he wouldn't hurt her children, but he didn't have time to get them out of the car. So he took off. He drove away with the two kids in their car seats. Susan frantically ran to the nearest home, which was Shirley McLeod's, to call the police. Now, Sheriff Wells, realizing the exigency of this case and the need for all hands on deck, called in SLED. That's South Carolina Law Enforcement Division. We've talked about them before in other episodes, I believe. Wells quickly mobilized searches to look for Susan's vehicle, who everyone hoped had her children safely inside of it.
I was picturing things different. This was how far from her home did she say this carjacking occurred?
So it's not that far. I mean, within 10 miles.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's not. It was local. She was out locally taking a drive to a lake. She said she was going to feed the ducks with her kids, which she sometimes did. She usually did it at a different lake, though. So this was a new one for her.
And she didn't know Shirley. She was just a random
person. Yeah, she was a random person whose house was nearest to the lake. Now, the search utilized cars, helicopters, and divers because it was near a lake. And investigators immediately began searching that lake near where Susan said she was forced out of her car. While the investigation was underway, Susan and David stayed with Susan's parents as family continued to be with them and surround them. Even though Susan and David were separated and were headed for divorce, they were very supportive of each other at this time, and they were leaning on each other. The press caught onto this story very quickly, and representatives from the Adam Walsh Center even helped to distribute information. I think most people know who Adam Walsh is, but for anyone who might not, Adam Walsh was abducted at 8 years old from a Florida shopping mall. This was in 1981. And sadly, I mean, very sadly, only part of his body was recovered 2 weeks later. His parents became fierce advocates for missing children, lobbying for stronger databases for these cases and laws that protected children from sexual predators. So the most famous of which to pass was the Comprehensive Adam Walsh Act.
And his father, I was just going to say who his father is, right? Go ahead, sorry.
Yes, John Walsh later went on to host America's Most Wanted, a show that broadcasted fugitives across the nation, and it was quite successful in recovering many of them.
Yeah, I think every household had that show on in the 90s. It scared the crap out of me, though. Weren't you scared as a kid watching that?
I should have been scared watching the things I watched as a kid, but unfortunately, I wasn't. Again, it just...
No, okay.
It kind of invited me to work in this field that I found interesting. That one, I watched America's Most Wanted, but I had also watched Unsolved Mysteries, which probably also scared you if you watched it, no?
Well, you know, it's funny, Megan. I watch Rescue 911 a lot.
Rescue 911, isn't that a spoof?
It was a show where they would reenact emergency situations. It was around the same time, like in the 90s. It was like very bad acting if you look back. Like the dramatizations are ridiculous, but...
Okay, sorry. I did not know that one at all. And for some reason, because I know that you don't usually watch those, I thought you would have watched something that was... not as serious. Years later, I found it interesting that in Unsolved Mysteries, they say, when possible, we've invited people to reenact with us. And I thought, oh, so you're going to re-traumatize them again by acting out some awful experience.
Different times.
Yes, but I did watch the shows. Anyway, back to Susan and David. The press was available for them. And David made a very public plea with Susan by his side, begging whomever had taken their children to bring them home. Now, as a standard part of the investigation, Amy, Susan and David were both given polygraph tests during their interview on October 27th. According to reports, David passed outright, but Susan's test was inconclusive, with Susan showing possible deceptiveness when asked if she knew where her children were. So this caused concern from the start for the police, who also thought that there were some inconsistencies with Susan's story.
Build healthy habits the easy way with nutritious recipes from the number one meal kit for clean eating.
Green Chef is the number one meal kit for clean eating and ranked the number one meal kit overall by U.S. News and World Report.
One of the greatest things about Green Chef is that each week you can easily customize your meals to suit your lifestyle. With preferences like keto, plant-based, Mediterranean, gut and brain health, calorie smart, quick and easy, protein-packed, and gluten-free.
You can even mix and match meals and flavors from different dietary preferences. So if your household is like my household, where people have different preferences, you can please everybody with one box.
I have to tell you, my meals this week make me so happy, and I swear the secret is the sauce. I'm having the Southwest pork fillet with mango slaw and a wonderful cilantro vinaigrette. After that, I'm going to be having a beef tenderloin. And then finally, I'm topping off my week with a Mediterranean chicken with a chimichurri sauce. These meals and sauces are absolute perfection, and they're good for me.
April is Earth Month, and sustainability is core to the Green Chef brand. Green Chef offsets 100% of delivery emissions and 100% of plastic in each box.
With their breakfast bites, 10-minute lunches, and then dinners ready in 30 minutes, you are saving time every day in the kitchen. Go to greenchef.com/women50 and use code women50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next 2 months.
Go to greenchef.com/women50 and use code women50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next 2 months.
Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well.
She had told them that she was going to visit a friend on the evening of the abduction because it was an evening and she had put the kids in the car after dinner. But when police interviewed that friend, he said that he was out that night, and to the best of his knowledge, he had no idea that Susan was coming over to visit him. They didn't make plans. Possibly more alarming was Susan said that she had gone to the nearby Walmart and I guess walked the aisles, shopped around for a while, but detectives could not find anyone when they canvassed it who remembered her or the children in the store or anywhere near it. And when confronted with this information, remember this is pre-surveillance, Susan responded that she actually wasn't in Walmart and that instead she really was driving around for a while, but she thought that telling the police that she was driving around would sound suspicious, so she lied.
Yeah, lying's a little more suspicious.
Yeah. I think so as well. And that one was a big red flag, I think. Now, that red stoplight that Susan said she was accosted at, remember she gave the precise location?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out, and I didn't know this was a thing, but it turns out that stoplight was permanently green unless triggered by other cars like slowing or lingering. Yes.
Okay.
You know that? Okay.
I remember like if you approach like a red light, if you still like flash your high beams, it would turn. So some lights will stay, I guess in like small towns, a light is going to stay one color until a car comes the other way.
Okay. Yeah. Honestly, I didn't know this, but that was the case. And as Susan had said, she reported that there was nobody around when she stopped at this red light. So
interesting.
Now, this doesn't seem plausible based on the information that this light was permanently green.
So interesting. Little did she know she picked the wrong light, right?
Picked the wrong light. And then there was the bombshell piece of evidence for investigators that came after they spoke with Susan's boyfriend, Tom Finley, with whom she had told the police she was in a happy relationship with. But according to Tom, he had just ended the relationship only days before the children disappeared. The reason? He liked Susan, but he did not want the responsibility of children.
I mean, motive, right?
Exactly. So the question then became, had Susan Smith killed her own children so she could be with this man?
Can you remind me how old the children were?
Yes. Michael was 3 years old and Alex was 15 months. At this point, investigators really believe that Susan was responsible for the disappearance of her children.
Did David suspect, and like at some point, did David also start turning on Susan, or was he standing by Susan at this point?
Absolutely not. He believed her 100%.
Okay.
He stood by her, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But detectives were quietly building the case. And they did confront Susan with the inconsistencies. They were interrogating her or interviewing her pretty much daily while her children were missing. And then they confronted her with this new information from Tom Finley, asking Susan, is this the reason why you killed your children? But Susan was adamant that she had not harmed her children and that there was no man that could ever come between her and her boys. The police continued to solicit tips from the public and continued to search the lake, but they weren't finding anything. By day four, there was still no sign of Susan's vehicle or the boys, but law enforcement was still firing up on all cylinders. They were really going hard at this. And 2 days later, they got a huge tip, Amy. A young boy was found in a vehicle with South Carolina license plates at a hotel in Seattle, having been abandoned, reportedly, by a male driver.
Oh.
Now, the boy was about 14 or 15 months in age, which was Alex's age.
Mm-hmm.
So the police, even though they had thought Susan had done something, they were kind of hopeful that this was perhaps Alex Smith, the younger child.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, it was a child who matched Alex's description, but it was not him. I think everyone was a bit deflated after that, but investigators' focus lasered in on Susan.
Well, Susan knew it wasn't going to be him.
Susan knew that, absolutely, but everyone else was hopeful, including David. Can imagine what he was going through with his children missing.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible. If you've seen the press, the pleas that he made, he was absolutely desperate and hysterical. I mean, he clearly loved his children and wanted them back. So they continued to interview Susan every day, trying to elicit a confession from her. On the ninth day of the investigation, Susan and David were interviewing with some television shows. And at this point, Amy, the media had started to ask if Susan had been responsible or involved with her son's death.
Oh.
Now, this was also, just so you know, coming off shortly after the time of Andrea Yates,
mm-hmm.
who in Texas was convicted of killing her children.
Well, you covered that case, right?
I covered it for a Patreon episode. So one of our supporter-only episodes.
Oh, okay.
This was also several years later after Diane Downs had been convicted. Mm-hmm. And I will say Diane Downs was convicted of murdering her children in a very similar situation.
Mm-hmm.
She also blamed a black male carjacker. And it was also shown that, in fact, she murdered her own children because she wanted to be with a man. So the press was starting to question this, but David stood by Susan on television as she told the country that she loved her children and she had nothing to do with their disappearance.
Did Susan rekindle with that? What was the man's name that she was dating again?
Tom Finley? No.
She didn't rekindle with him.
Okay. Well, at this point, it was all, the focus was all on the children. Tom had called her at one point to say that he was very sorry
mm-hmm.
about her children, and she had made a strange comment. Something about their inquiring about their relationship, to which he said, don't worry about that, Susan, like focus on your children.
Yeah.
So there was an odd comment, but that's all the connection that they had. Later the same day after they had done some press, Susan had to meet with Sheriff Wells for yet another interview. This time Wells invited her to a small church near the sheriff's station. At this point, Amy, it was clear that the stress of the interviews and the scrutiny from the press was beginning to wear on Susan. She was tiring. In a gentler approach this time, Sheriff Wells told Susan that her story simply could not be true. And guiding her through, he said, Susan, it's time to tell the truth. And this time, Susan did just that. She told Wells that the story about a carjacker was a lie, and that she had indeed killed her sons, Michael and Alex. According to Susan, she had never intended just to kill the boys. Rather, feeling so depressed, isolated, and lonely, she thought that the three of them should die together because she believed that the children couldn't live without their mother. So she felt that she couldn't just take her own life because she did not think the boys would be able to survive that. She said this was her plan when she drove along that highway on October 25th to a lake that she had never been to. Only something happened after she pulled the parking brake. She said that she drove the car into the lake at the driver's seat, but instead of staying in the car, she pulled the brake and she got out of the vehicle while it sank into the lake with her children in it, her sleeping children at the time. Yeah, it's very hard to hear the details of this case. Susan then ran to the house of Shirley McLeod in an attempt to create an alibi, panicking at what she had done and knowing that she couldn't undo it.
Wow.
Susan was arrested for 2 counts of murder after this confession. With a more precise story and location as well, the divers went back to the murky lake, and this time they recovered the vehicle with the bodies of Michael and Alex Smith inside. It was an awful tragedy all round for everyone, Amy, but it was only the beginning of the press and the legal nightmare ahead.
I can't even imagine how the father was dealing with this. He was standing by Susan, and then to find out that she took the children from him like that is just so hard to understand.
You know, I've read that there were times where in the beginning he was sympathetic before he knew the full story. I think believing that Susan was mentally ill, but once he had heard the full details, he became very angry. And I don't think that anger left him through the years. Susan was charged, as I said, with two counts of murder, and she was held without bail, while her parents hired attorney David Bruck, who specialized in death penalty cases, to represent her. South Carolina has the death penalty, so yes, this was likely going to be a death penalty case, which I do not think came as a surprise to anyone. Meanwhile, Susan was diagnosed with depression, and she was held on suicide watch for 8 months prior to her trial. An evaluation, however, did show that Susan was competent to stand trial, which commenced in July of 1995. It's surprising. It was less than a year from the time she was arrested to the time of her trial. We find that surprising now because these major murder cases usually wait about 3 years, I'd say, on average.
Yep.
It was as big of a media circus as the O.J. Simpson case. I believe Susan's case actually came right after OJ's, but the media storm had already been created around his case and every time he was in court. So the judge was very fearful that the media would influence the jury, so he banned them from the courtroom. When the trial began, the prosecution argued that Susan was a selfish, manipulative woman whose children were in the way of her relationship with Tom Finley, and so she got rid of them. They said it was just as cold and just as callous as that. Finley's testimony only supported the prosecution's theory, as he explained that he wrote Susan a letter just days before the murders, ending his relationship. I just want to read you a brief excerpt from this letter. "You will, without a doubt, make some lucky man a great wife, but unfortunately, it won't be me." Another passage stated, "Susan, I could really fall for you. You have some endearing qualities about you, and I think you are a terrific person. But like I have told you before, there are some things about you that aren't suited for me. And yes, I am speaking about your children." As you said before, it was motive. Co-workers of Susan's testified that she discussed how different her life might be if she hadn't married and had children so young with David. Investigators testified about the inconsistencies in her story and eventual confession, which Susan never disputed.
She was just trying to get reduced culpability or diminished capacity for her mental health.
Absolutely correct, because the case was a strong one, but what about the defense? Would Susan's team plead insanity, which was a question? She had confessed, so insanity or diminished capacity or a lesser offense, these were the only ways she could go. But Susan had been deemed very competent, which meant that she was capable of understanding her actions as well. And it did seem that based on the events, the planning, the aftermath, that insanity was going to be a real stretch. Her team felt that insanity was off the table. They just didn't think they would be able to make it work.
I also think her hiding and lying, right?
Yeah.
Insanity is when you don't know the difference between right and wrong. And she clearly knew what she did was wrong, because why else did she need to lie?
Well, that was part of it. I mean, they felt that they just had too big of a hurdle to overcome. So they were going for sympathy. They called a psychiatrist who testified that Susan's depression had escalated to suicidal proportions. They said that Susan felt such extreme loneliness and a profound fear of being alone, which was the reason that they said she had entered into a series of sexual relationships with several men prior to her crimes. Apparently, it was something like 4 different men with whom she had sexual relations in the weeks leading to the murder. But the bombshell, Amy, was that one of these men was none other than Bev Russell, her stepfather.
So she is now seeing him consensual, she's now consenting to a relationship with her stepfather?
Yes. So it appeared that her relationship was no longer assault, but consensual as she was of age. Now, we could still argue that it was abusive and wrong, but not illegal. But it was clearly part of a destructive pattern.
Is Bev still with Linda at this point?
They divorced.
Okay.
It does seem, Amy, that Susan had sexual relations with men and she wanted to be loved. It seemed like this was part of her pattern. But if Susan was so depressed and suicidal, the question is, why didn't she take her own life? The doctor's explanation was that it was survival mode and it wasn't planned, but it was a reflex of self-preservation. Susan's defense concluded that she was a very damaged, depressed woman with a history of suicide attempts and that she was not a malicious, cold-blooded killer. So they appealed to the jury to consider a conviction of manslaughter based on the notion that this was a botched suicide attempt brought on by Susan's history.
No, no, no.
Well, the jury deliberated for less than 3 hours, which is not a lot of time in a case like this. Mm-mm. And in the end, they found Susan guilty on both counts of murder. The next question, more importantly, would her sentence be life or death? In the penalty phase, the prosecution put a devastated David on the stand to relate to the jury his pain and loss for the rest of his life. Very impactful. But the defense put on Susan's relatives to beg for her mercy, and one such witness was Bev Russell, her stepfather, who openly told the jury that he was responsible for a lot of the tragedy, that he had molested Susan when she was a child and continued an unhealthy relationship, a sexual one, with Susan as an adult. He pleaded for his life as well, seemingly taking responsibility for the role that he played in who Susan had become. Susan did not testify at either trial, leaving it up to the jurors to decide her fate without hearing from her. Again, the jurors deliberated for just under 3 hours, but this time the verdict favored Susan and spared her the death penalty. The jury voted that Susan Smith be sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole in 30 years. And that parole, Amy, is quite close now.
That means she would be serving till she's what, at least 60-ish?
No, she was young, and Susan is coming up for parole in November of 2024, and right now she's 51 years old. So let's talk about where she is now and this possibility of parole. Susan's currently serving her time at Leith Correctional Center in Greenwood, South Carolina. The announcement of her pending parole this year has put Susan back in the media spotlight. Her time behind bars, though, hasn't exactly been without incident. So she's been disciplined on multiple occasions for illicit drug use. And while she was also disciplined for having sexual relations with more than one correctional officer, we know that this is not consensual in prison, and rather this constitutes sexual assault on behalf of those officers. Nonetheless, she was disciplined for this behavior at the time.
I hope they were disciplined too.
They were as well. One of them lost his job, but there was two officers and neither was subject to any criminal penalties. Nonetheless, this behavior and incidents of self-mutilation have been documented throughout her sentence. I don't know how extensive self-mutilation was. I didn't read anything about hospitalizations, but I'm not sure. More recently, in the last few years, Susan's been corresponding with potential suitors outside the prison walls. According to reports, she has had many offers from men who would like to take care of her, and even had a boyfriend as of recently who has children. Though I don't know the age of his children. One of her relatives said the following, quote, "She's always been into guys, obviously. It would be the best case scenario for her to be in a relationship. So she's hoping to find the right man to live with if she gets out." I think this is incorrect, and I'd like to discuss why I think so. Mm-hmm. This sentiment. Susan was diagnosed with depression, which I believe is accurate. Mm-hmm. She was also diagnosed with dependent personality disorder. Well, I don't know if you had ever heard that about her.
I was wondering if there's any borderline personality disorder.
Okay. Dependent personality centers around a fear of abandonment, the need to be taken care of, difficulty making decisions without the help of others, avoidance of adult responsibilities, and certainly a neediness. So there does seem to be an overlap with borderline personality. There are similarities, but borderline personality is also characterized by excessive moodiness, unstable relationships, impulsivity, characteristics that do seem to be more in line with Susan's behavior. We also have seen a number of criminal or violent behaviors aligned with this personality disorder in particular. I mean, I certainly believe that early events in Susan's life, mm-hmm. violence in the home, suicide of her father, and molestation by her stepfather, mm-hmm. I think these severe traumas led to Susan's personality disorder.
Yeah, I definitely have some sympathy for what she went through.
Of course, we look at people after the fact and we look at them as, quote, monsters, and the acts are, of course, awful, but there doesn't seem to be much of a focus on what traumas they might have suffered as a child. And it's important. It's part of the picture.
It doesn't excuse it.
No.
But it helps us understand it.
It helps explain it, right? Mm-hmm. And there's one last thing I want to add with here, or one last thing I want to discuss when it comes to the types of mothers who kill, is that there are different typologies. It's not a one size fits all. So I want to just discuss these categories. And this is very important in understanding prevention, treatment, or punishment. So as I teach it also and understand it, altruistic murder is a category where the mother believes that she is murdering her child to help the child. And Andrea Yates is the classic example here. Hmm. She killed her children because she believed that they were possessed by Satan and it was the only way mm-hmm. she could save their souls. So this is one. This is altruistic. And this is very different than what happened to Susan Smith. And it's why Andrea Yates was found guilty by insanity. Mm-hmm. The second category is very close, postpartum psychosis, which also is what Andrea Yates was experiencing. So there's overlap. And this is murder due to extreme mental illness. And oftentimes this one corresponds with voices, hearing voices to do something. Dina Schlosser was a Texan woman who had called 911 in 2004 because she had cut her baby's arms off of the baby's body. It was an awful scenario. She said she heard voices telling her to do so, and she was deemed mentally ill by the courts as well. The baby died. There's a third category, and this is killing an unwanted infant where the mother didn't want the child to begin with. This is often those younger mothers, Amy. I'm sure we've actually covered a case like this. Ones who ignore their pregnancies.
Brooke Schuyler Richardson would fit that.
Yes, and I did cover her case. Mm-hmm. So this is mothers who... they ignore it. They don't want to believe that they're pregnant. Brooke Schuyler Richardson was definitely one of the most recent examples here. And so, again, these women tend to deliver babies in secret and kill them.
No, I was also going to say Kelly Lane would fit under that one as well. Remember Kelly Lane story from Australia?
Yes, yes, Kelly mm-hmm. Lane. Yes, as well. Yep. So these are women who are in denial about the pregnancies. The fourth category is accidental death of a child following child abuse and mistreatment. So these are pretty self-explanatory, even though they didn't necessarily mean to kill their children. They are abusive mothers. Mm-hmm. Factitious disorder imposed on another, or Munchausen by proxy, also fits under this category because it's a syndrome where women abuse their children or cause them hospitalization to garner attention. So it's a very controversial diagnosis, also because it's seen as a mental illness, but also a form of abuse. Mm-hmm. There's another category, which is filicide due to neglect. So this is not quite abuse outright, but usually reckless or negligent behavior. This is a category mm-hmm. of women who might shake their babies, let's say, to quiet them, but they don't mean to necessarily kill them, but you should know better. A fifth category is murder that's used as an act of revenge, usually against a former spouse. And remember, all these categories are rare, but I do remember a case like this, Stacey Smalls. She killed her 18-month-old twins, mm-hmm. and she did this to punish her husband, who she believed was having an affair with a family member. And I don't know if you remember this, but she sprayed the words on his car, "I hope she was worth it." This was an awful, awful case. Mm-hmm. There are those that are assisted or coerced filicide. We have definitely covered this, where a woman has an abusive partner. The partner is usually not the biological parent, and mm-hmm. either the partner coerces them into abusing their child or coerces them to stay silent.
I mean, Crystal Straw is a perfect example of that one.
Yes.
We just covered that.
Absolutely, and we just covered that case. And then finally, we have the category of women who kill their children to rid themselves of a burden. And that's usually because mm-hmm. they want to be with a man.
There we go.
Susan Smith fits in this category, as did Diane Downs, who I discussed mm-hmm. earlier. So when we look at this, it helps us understand the different levels. And it helps us understand that Susan, while suffering from depression, which I understand that she had, and possibly borderline personality disorder, which I believe is a correct assessment, also had the capability of understanding right from wrong. And it does seem that her motive was to rid herself of her children, to rid herself of her children.
Has she shown any remorse at all?
I don't know if I would say it's remorse. Susan has said that she's responsible for what she did, but she's misunderstood and that she wasn't in her right mind.
Okay.
So it's mixed. It's possible that she's shown real remorse with other people. I don't know to what level she feels responsible. Mm-hmm. She does believe that she believes that her actions were because she was absolutely in a state where she couldn't comprehend what she was doing or understand the consequences, and that so she wasn't quite as responsible for her actions.
Her ex-husband, I'm assuming they had no communication once she was incarcerated. I really hope he
No, went. They divorced okay. shortly after.
Please tell me he went on to have a family or live somewhat of a happy life.
So it's a good question. He did go on. He remarried and he had other children. I believe he divorced. Mm-hmm. I did see something that he said in the press. I'm a great father, but I'm kind of a lousy husband. I read that once and I don't know if that was just pertaining to Susan, but he... still thinks about his kids all the time, mm-hmm. and he still lives with the anger of it. And I would suspect that he will be at this parole hearing.
Yeah.
Now, her sentence to me was, I guess, appropriate, although I'm not sure why she's given the possibility of parole. I think a life sentence, straight life sentence would have been more appropriate. Parole concerns me for Susan Smith, particularly, as I said before, I thought it very concerning what her family member said about the best scenario with her would be being in a relationship, being taken care of. I think that the relationship or the letters and the communication she's having with men are very indicative of this persisting personality disorder.
I agree.
And maybe untreated personality disorder. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's dangerous because what's to say she's not going to get in a relationship and then if something goes sour, she's going to do something again to harm either her. This could be to protect herself as well.
Yes.
Because I think she still has I think there's still a good chance that she would self-harm if a man left her.
Yes.
Or hurt someone else. I don't know. I would be curious to know, is she on medication? It sounds like she's still struggling with some stuff. I would hope that she received some programming to help her with her mental health all those years. It's not sounding good.
I mean, borderline personality is hard to treat, and I don't know what the therapy would be like in prison. I can tell you that I'd be very concerned, mm-hmm. given these relationships she's seeking to establish with various different men, that her reliance on male relationships is a problem still. And mm-hmm. I think it would absolutely lead to a future violent act if she couldn't cope with the results.
I would bet that she's not going to get parole.
No.
Maybe again in the future, but I think it'll be denied, especially with all of the attention in the media.
Right. So my second point was going to be just that, yeah. Amy, that I do not believe Susan will be granted parole. Her crimes are also just too high profile. And for me, I think that Susan Smith needs to remain incarcerated, both for her crimes and because I don't believe that she's shown the proper signs of rehabilitation just yet.
If they let her out, we are coming back for an update because I will be so shocked.
I would be very surprised if they let her out. Look, if they do, we can only hope that she is rehabilitated. Mm-hmm. But I'd be very concerned for public safety as well. Mm-hmm. So we'll be keeping our eyes on that one in November of 2024. Okay, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. Again, even though you know the story, there was so much more that I learned from it, and I hope that you all did as well.
Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Bel Castro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso. And music is by Desert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime.
Sources for today's episode include crimelibrary.org, People.com, Fox News, Stacey Malakoth's book, Women, Gender, and Crime, and Meyer and Oberman's book, When Mothers Kill, Interviews from Prison.